You may have heard your mother admonishing, learn to appreciate the little things in life. Well, we've decided to take a closer look at that saying, quite literally. Good morning, I'm George Bodarkey, and this is Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. This morning on Cityscape, we're delving into all manner of teeny tiny things in New York City, from an artist's ant farms to a miniature book collection to a filmmaker's version of a toy land. Tiny things in the Big Apple. This morning on Cityscape. Glad you're with us. Most people consider ants to be pesky, irksome creatures to be disposed of with rage. But one Brooklyn-based artist says to her, ants are very relevant because of their similarity to human beings. And she's found a way to combine her passion for ants with her art.
My name is Kristen Benson. I'm an artist and a designer, and I live in Brooklyn.
You create art using ant farms.
Right, I do. I wanted to talk about life and the way we live in New York City, also as well as social and psychological, the way we live that way also.
What do you see as the parallels between we New Yorkers and the ants?
I originally started thinking about the way we live in boxes. We're transported in boxes via the subway. When you think of the subway and us in the subway, you see a parallel to the ants tunneling in their environment. There's a visual connection also.
Now, you've created several sculptures where you've incorporated ant farms, right?
Yes, I have many. I made a clock.
Let me stop you at the clock, because
yes.
The clock has a very interesting concept behind it as well, and I think we as New Yorkers can certainly relate to the clock.
Yes, and everybody can, because I feel like I'm always pressed for time. You know, you wake up in the morning to an alarm clock, your day is dictated by the clock, and I just feel I'm always pressed for time. So I took the clock and put the ants in there, but the clock, you know, represents this thing that manages my life, and I don't really like it. Also, by putting them in the clock, you know, the clock is rendered useless.
You also created an ant farm using a television tube, again, with another interesting idea behind it.
Right. The TV, I think it distances us from our lives, as do a lot of our electronic devices in our lives. You know, there's life on television, but it doesn't have any basis in real life a lot of times. Even a nature show is edited and, you know, fits a format.
So here we are watching a different kind of action in the television.
Absolutely. You know, it's a nature show right there. It's educational. It's fascinating. And it's beautiful. I think ants are really beautiful. There's a lot of different kinds of ants. There's ants that are farmers. There's ants that are slave makers. There's ants that are more marauding types, more militaristic, if you like. Because I wanted to describe life, something living, so I chose the ants.
What kinds of ants do you use in your ant farm sculptures?
They are California harvester ants, and I use them because they're available.
So you can get them online?
You can, yes. Also, they'll dig right away, and they'll dig during the day, and they're not so fussy about having sunlight and that sort of thing.
How many ants per ant farm, would you say?
Well, it depends on the size, but usually there's about 25. In larger pieces, there's, you know, 50.
How do you find that people react to this art?
Some people are really fascinated by it and have their own insect stories to tell me. Some people are really horrified and grossed out by it, and they also think that I'm cruel for putting them in these ant farms. But I actually take very good care of them. And when they die, I use dead ants and make jewelry with them. So, you know, so I actually use their bodies when they're done.
So how frequently do you dream up new kinds of ant farms to create?
I have a lot of things that I'd like to do. I'd like to do subway doors. I would like to do a giant dining table and chairs. I think that'd be fantastic. I would like to make really tall, tall shoes. This whole high heel thing, like, it mystifies me. They're like skyscrapers, these things, and it's, I can't imagine how the women walk around in these things. God bless them.
There are endless possibilities, it seems, when it comes to creating ant farms for you.
Absolutely.
Kristen, thank you so much for sharing your story.
Thank you so much for coming, and thanks.
You can learn more about Kristen Benson and her unusual art at kristenbenson.com. From tiny art to a tiny and very cute New York City. Directed and shot by Sam O'Hare, The Sand Pit is a 5-minute time-lapse film using tilt-shift photography to depict a day in the life of New York City, which looks positively miniature. This internet sensation got Sam adulation from adults and kids alike and catapulted the British artist to almost celebrity status. Sam, welcome to Cityscape.
Hey, thanks. Nice to be here.
The taxis, the construction equipment, the helicopters in this video all look like toys, but they're not toys. They're the real thing.
Yeah.
How did you make that happen?
The technique is tilt-shift time-lapse photography. The standard way of doing this is to use a tilt-shift lens. That is a lens that can offset the plane of the lens itself from the plane of the sensor in the camera or the film. That basically allows you to kind of blur out the top and bottom of the image or each side of the image so you kind of appear to give depth of field to a large scene, and that kind of cues your mind into thinking that it's small. And the other thing is that it's all sped up. So I shot most of the footage at 4 frames a second as stills, and then it's played back at 24 frames a second. So everything's accelerated a little bit. So things at a large scale, like the boats and the water and stuff, they kind of flow more quickly, which makes it appear to be smaller.
This film is about 5 minutes long. How many stills did you take?
In total, there were 35,000.
Wow.
Just over. Although 7,200 made it into the final thing because it's exactly 5 minutes.
Where did you shoot from?
I put the word out to people who I knew who had access to like rooftops and balconies and that sort of thing. And then a lot of it was just done from publicly accessible areas. So I shot quite a lot from the Manhattan Bridge and the Brooklyn Bridge. And I got access to a penthouse apartment on Fifth Avenue by the Metropolitan Art Museum. I shot from the Millennium Hilton Hotel in Ground Zero. And a friend of a friend's apartment, which looks down over Ground Zero.
I also recognize the development of Brooklyn Bridge Park, right?
Yep, that's right, from Brooklyn Heights. And they let me up on one of the penthouse balconies to shoot from there, too.
So only the two boroughs, though, Manhattan and Brooklyn in this film.
That's right, yeah.
How come you didn't go out to the other boroughs?
I don't know many people who have access to places in those. I'm on the Upper West Side, and I know people in Brooklyn and around Manhattan. But
the bottom line is you have to shoot from above for this kind of film.
Exactly, yeah. You need to be at a high angle.
What inspired you to miniaturize New York City?
Well, I always love like time-lapse films, stuff like Koyaanisqatsi, which has got lots of beautiful time-lapse photography. And I'd seen this technique done before, but I hadn't seen it been done well in a city. And I wanted to just do this with New York because I knew that it's an amazing subject to capture.
No, I can detect from that accent of yours that you're not from New York originally.
No, I'm not. I'm from the UK. I was born in Kent and grew up in Nottingham, and I was living in Liverpool before I came over here 2.5 years ago.
How do you think your view of New York City is different from our view, the native New Yorker?
I love the city. I love the way it's laid out and designed, and I love the, I don't know, it feels much more friendly than a lot of places I've been in the UK. It kind of has a reputation for not being friendly compared to the rest of America, but I don't know if that's the people here or just the way it's kind of constructed.
What do you think miniaturizing the city does when you look at it in that way? Do you think it changes the way we see the city?
A lot of people reacted to it, I think, kind of emotionally from seeing places that they know well, kind of from a completely different angle and a different way. I think it kind of lets you sort of step back from everything and kind of view it as a whole, but it's also, I don't know, it lets you study stuff kind of almost in detail, even though things are very small, but, you know, the kind of flows and the movement in the city, and lets you kind of see a sort of a little bit about how it kind of lives and breathes, you know, the pulses and rhythms.
It's interesting because it's fast-paced, but yet it's very slow. It almost slows the city down, even though it's in high speed.
Yeah. I wanted to kind of make the edit a little bit languid so that it wasn't too choppy. It was kind of relatively smooth, and the scenes would kind of lead on from one another naturally. So I did some small camera moves and things in post.
The nighttime shots in particular are very interesting to watch.
Yeah, I shot all of those long exposure. Most of the film, as I said, was 4 frames a second, but these actually was doing 2-second exposures for a lot of it so that you get the kind of streaks and movement of the car lights. It's kind of very fluid and smooth.
Did you encounter any particular challenges by shooting from so high up?
Not really. I mean, I did it during the hottest week of the year, but one thing that was difficult was that I wasn't able to use a tripod at a lot of places because at the edge of rooftops and things, you can't necessarily get a tripod to fit. The shots would come out slightly wobbly. I could then go in and remove that wobble in post.
Now, this film was pretty much an internet sensation. People loved this film.
Yeah, it kind of exploded much more than I thought it was going to be. I mean, I did it to try and gain exposure for myself because for doing as a commercial director, and it, yes, just took off. It had been online for 5 days. I think it had 200,000 views, and it's mainly through social media. It got tweeted by a few people, and that got picked up by a few other people, and then some people who have, like, you know, tens of thousands of followers tweeted about it, and suddenly it just grew from there.
What has been the most memorable response that you received? Because I know a lot of people have posted comments.
I certainly got a lot of people saying that it made them homesick for New York, people who lived here and then moved away. But also, I got a few people contact me saying that their children absolutely love it and were mesmerized by it, and that it's like toys coming to life, you know, which I thought was great. I was actually contacted by director for children's hospitals in Minnesota, who asked if they could put it on their internal CCTV for, you know, for their recuperation and stuff, which was great.
That's fantastic. Any plans to miniaturize anything else?
Well, actually, I'm working on a film for the Coachella Music Festival, which I'm hoping to finish in the next few weeks. I went out and shot it in Palm Springs, and so it's kind of telling a story of the experience of Coachella.
All right, Sam, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you very much. Pleasure.
If you'd like to take a look at this truly amazing short film, just Google The Sand Pit. You're tuned to Cityscape on 90.7 FM and WFUV.org. Good morning once again. I'm George Bodarkey. Among the treasures at the Morgan Library and Museum in Midtown Manhattan are items that fit in perfectly with this morning's theme of tiny things in the big city. The Morgan has a diverse collection of miniature books that I had the pleasure of learning all about from two very knowledgeable guys.
My name is Roger Wick, and I'm curator of medieval and Renaissance manuscripts here at the Morgan Library and Museum.
I'm John Bidwell, and I'm curator of printed books and bindings here at the Morgan.
Are there standards for what defines a miniature book, John?
Yes, indeed. If you are a member of the Miniature Book Society, your regulations are that it should be no larger than 3 inches. Some people insist on even smaller measurements, but at least American usage, 3 inches is the rule.
Roger, do you have your own definition?
No, we're fine with that.
Why create a book so small?
Well, in the world of manuscripts, there actually was a tradition for French queens to own very, very small books, a tradition that goes back to the 14th century. And it's almost as if the women were more interested in books as jewelry and special effects books than they were items to actually be prayed from.
It's certainly easier to carry a lot of them around, isn't it, John?
In the world of printed books, portability is key. So in our collection, we have almanacs, calendars, dictionaries, editions of the Psalms, Shakespeare songs. Texts like children's books are amenable to the miniature book format.
Now, you brought some out for us to see. Which are these books here?
Well, I can show you, for example, I think this is a charming book, Weeds in My Garden. Now, there's plenty of books about flowers, but who pays attention to weeds? Well, these are lovely wood-engraved pictures of weeds, hand-colored. This book is no larger than 2 inches. And it's in a sumptuous blue Morocco binding. So rarely do you see people pay so much attention and value so highly weeds like white clover, black medic, red clover, and so on.
Let me point out that you are reading that book with the naked eye. You do not have a magnifying glass.
This book is in 6-point type. Your usual trade paperback is in 10. 6, for me, is rough going.
Roger, what about you and these books over here?
Well, I have brought the very small book of ours, and it is painted in grisaille, which means colors of gray, mostly gray. And I did a little measurement before you came in preparation, measured each line of text, which is 1/16 of an inch tall, And the small letter O, for instance, is about the size of the head of a straight pin. But it's actually very legible, provided you can read Gothic script. I do it with the aid of my reading glasses. But it actually is a complete book. It's rather fat. It's about 1/2 inch. And it's in, I would say, John, 18th century binding?
18th century red Morocco, it looks to me. Could be a lovely French gilt binding with beautiful decorative fly leaves, a pattern that some people call Dutch gilt.
What is your favorite book in the collection, John, that you have?
One of the major genres in the printed books world is the so-called thumb Bible. And that's an attempt to get the entire Bible abridged so you can get it in the palm of your hand. And the Morgan is very fortunate to have the earliest English thumb Bible, printed in 1601 and written by a bad poet. His name was John Weaver, and he didn't have much of a career, but he did introduce this new genre which caught on as a curiosity, and it is known that these books were handed around the court in England as novelties.
Talk to me, John, if you will, a little bit more about what is suitable for a miniature book.
Basically, anything that you can boil down into a book that will fit in the palm of your hand or in a vest pocket will work. And so a enterprising publisher will look for a classic text, Shakespeare or Dickens.
How different is it in your world, Roger?
My world is rather different. But within the restrictions of my world, there are very interesting things to be had. By restrictions, I mean that most of the small books in medieval and Renaissance manuscripts end up being books of hours or other kinds of prayer books. I have in my hand, for instance, one of the smaller books that we have in the collection, but it's, well, I measured 2 5/8 by 1 7/8 inches. It was the gift 2 years ago, just 2 years ago in 08, of Mrs. Alexandra P. Rosenberg. And it's a very special small book because it was a prayer book that a queen of France, Queen Claude de France, commissioned around the time of her coronation, right around 1517. She was only about 16, 17 at the time, so her eyes were very good. She could read very small script. And what she commissioned for herself was a small book that, even though it's very tiny, contains within it 132 illuminations, pictures from the life of the Virgin, the life of Christ, and a whole range of saints in which she was very fond.
I noticed that you're not handling these books with any special care. One would think that miniature books might be more fragile, but it does not seem like that's the case.
Well, the books that I've shown you here are all in very good bindings. And so we don't use gloves. And of course, you can't use supports because these are too small. You wouldn't be able to get it on a support. The difficult thing, and Roger can testify, is putting these books on exhibit. How are you going to get this in an exhibit case so that people can see it? Luckily, that's the conservator's challenge, not the curator's challenge.
Roger, John, thank you so much, Roger.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you.
The Morgan Library and Museum's Roger Wick and John Bidwell. From miniature books to miniature, well, just about everything, the tiny dollhouse on East 78th Street in Manhattan is like the Ethan Allen and Thomasville of the doll world. Besides shrunken furniture, the shop sells teeny tiny barbecue sets, dinnerware, oil paintings, Persian carpets, and the list goes on. We caught up with the store's owner of nearly 20 years.
My name is Leslie Edelman, and I am the owner of Tiny Doll House. The entire shop is filled with little things, replicating pretty much everything that you would have in full-size life. One side of our shop is devoted mostly to handcrafted items that are for the adult collector, and I buy these things from artisans all over the world. They can replicate a Chippendale chair and a French Louis XIV settee and so forth. We have Swarovski crystal chandeliers that actually do light, and almost anything that you can think of. The furniture is one of the things that truly impresses me the most, and that's the actual ability to do satinwood banding in miniature and carve legs of sofas and things that are totally done to scale. Everything we have here is a 1-inch = 1-foot scale. There are artists that specifically do miniature oil paintings. There are miniature porcelain artists, miniature doll makers, almost anything that you can think of. Visited quite a few of the artisans in their homes and their studios and seen the actual making of some of these items, and it amuses me when a customer comes in and says, well, how could this be so expensive? It's so small, you know, and you realize that it took the artist a month to make it. The priciest item I have is a reproduction Georgian bureau bookcase, which runs $2,600. Much of it is fantasy, and very often customers will build the house of their dreams, or they've always wanted to own a pastry shop, or they decided all of a sudden that they're a milliner and they'll do a little hat shop. So it's almost anything that you can think of or fantasize about, you can have. I just think there's a complete fascination with small things and things that you can hold in your hand and are reproductions in miniature of an item that you have in real life. And it's just, I think there's just a total fascination with little things.
The Tiny Dollhouse on East 78th Street in Manhattan. One-stop shopping for all things miniature. Reverend Jen, as she likes to be called, wears many hats: performer, poet, underground movie star, preacher, and lover and collector of troll dolls, many of them teeny tiny. She runs what she calls the Lower East Side Troll Museum. I recently visited with Reverend Jen and her trolls.
Hi, my name is Reverend Jen. We're here at the Lower East Side Troll Museum.
Tell me about the Troll Museum. How did this museum come to be?
Well, I had a few hundred trolls, and they were taking up a lot of space in the apartment, and I had this room that I use as a painting studio mostly, and I thought, well, why don't I just put all the trolls in one room and call it a troll museum?
How did you come to collect so many trolls?
Well, oftentimes people give me trolls, and I, you know, willingly take them. But I started collecting them when I was 11.
What drew you to trolls?
I like things that are cute and ugly, but I honestly don't know what the initial attraction was. Unlike, you know, they were very groovy. I like their smile, their outfits, et cetera, et cetera. And then as the years have gone by, since people know I like trolls, they'll bring them to... I host an open mic, so sometimes they'll bring me trolls to my open mic. Or I see them at a flea market. I don't buy trolls on eBay, generally, because that's like cheating, you know?
Do you recall the first troll that you collected?
She's right here. The big red-haired one.
Right up there.
In the yellow felt dress, yes. Her name is Adriana, and she's a Norfin troll. Norfin trolls are really the first type of troll that there ever was. A guy named Thomas Dam in the late 50s in Denmark carved a troll doll for his daughter and gave it to her for Christmas. And once her friends got a load of it, they were like, well, we want one. And then within a couple of years, there were troll factories all over Denmark. And then because of a flaw in the copyright license, a lot of companies started to market them. And one company in America started marketing Wishnik trolls, this company called You Need a Doll Company. So they really started to promote trolls to the counterculture. They would have ads with trolls in little groovy outfits with psychedelic lettering that said, like, groovy on them, or trolls in t-shirts that said, like, soap rot skin or don't blow my cool, things that would appeal to hippies. So they also became popular with hippies here. And then, obviously, in the early 90s, they had another phase where they just made a lot of toy companies a lot of money.
Now, is there any particular order to this museum to tell that history?
Well, as you can see from the museum, we don't have a lot of space here. So as head curator, that's been one very difficult thing. But I start with Adriana, so you see her when you walk in. And also then I get to tell people that Thomas Dam carved the first troll doll, which is an important thing to know. And then over next to it, I have some Wishniks from the 60s and a Wishnik animal from the 60s. It's like a giraffe troll. Kind of creepy. They don't make them anymore.
It is a little creepy.
Yeah, and then you come over here, and I like to get this out of the way at the very beginning. We have, like the Metropolitan Museum of Art has a suggested donation. We also have a suggested donation. However, it's $3,001. And the hope there is that someday someone will go, all right, I'll give you $3,001. I figure if you're going to suggest a donation, you should really suggest a very steep amount.
So I guess it hasn't happened yet.
Not yet. Usually people leave a dollar, or they bring beer or food or something. So, and above it, I have some literature that's a page out of Montgomery Ward's catalog in 1967. You can see that trolls, even a two-headed troll, an extremely rare two-headed troll, only cost 99 cents. Woo!
How much would it go for today?
Like $50, probably.
A lot of people think trolls are lucky. Are they?
Well, no, because I live with 350 or some odd amount, and I'm the least lucky person alive. However, I did actually win $20 on a scratch-off ticket today, so maybe the troll luck is starting to kick in.
How varied are the hair colors?
Well, Russ Berry alone made 700 varieties of trolls, so you can imagine there was every type of hair color in there. But really, you'll find, you know, blue, pink, purple, the entire spectrum of the rainbow. There's a whole lot of them.
These on this shelf here are particularly unique, unlike the other ones that we see on the shelves. Describe these for us.
That's the international shelf. Most of those trolls come from Norway or Denmark. They're obviously a little scarier than the other ones, but I thought it was important to represent trolls as they are in other countries, you know. But really what we celebrate here at the Troll Museum is the American troll doll. The Troll Museum is a museum for intellectuals, you know, and for other troll collectors and college students and artists and people who just want to have an extremely groovy experience.
Now, you said this museum is for the intellectual. What's the takeaway? What do you want people who come here to walk away with, to understand, to get?
Well, I want them to get the fact that if, you know, if you have an idea, you should just do it. That's kind of what the Troll Museum is really about. I mean, it's about trolls, yes, obviously. But what's happening in New York, it's just getting more and more normal, and that's tragic. So I'm really trying to sustain the weirdness of New York, you know. Well, I can't help it. I mean, I'm not a very normal person.
Is there any troll music, or if there were to be a theme song playing while one is visiting the Troll Museum, what would it be?
Well, there was an album made in the 60s called Wishnik Family Album, and it's really creepy. It's trolls singing, like, London Bridge is falling down, falling down. But I actually got my friend Brian to write a Troll Museum song. I wrote the lyrics, and he wrote the music, but it's very simple. It just goes, at the Troll Museum, you get the picture.
If you want to visit the Lower East Side Troll Museum, email Reverend Jen at revjen@revjen.com for an appointment. And that's it for this week's Cityscape. Remember, you can get past editions of Cityscape and learn how to podcast the show at WFUV.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, listed as WFUV Cityscape. Sign up to become a fan and a follower. I'm George Bodarkey. My thanks to senior producer Skylar Srivastava and producer Maureen Chin. Have a great weekend.
Hello, welcome to the Troll Museum.
The Troll Museum.